From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Insurance giant AIG has paid out big bucks bonuses to the tune of $165 million after receiving taxpayer bailout money in the billions to stay afloat. Outraged Senate leaders say they want it all back. Plus, former Vice President Dick Cheney says President Obama has made the United States less safe. And do we approve? A new Pew poll says the president's popular support is slipping away. Joining me now to analyze the week's political news is Sherrilyn Ifill, a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for The New York Post. Sherrilyn, Robert, nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here, Tony.
All right, we've got a lot to talk about, so let's jump right into it. $165 million, that's what people are arguing about today. A House Financial Services Subcommittee hearing into how and why the nearly bankrupt company AIG paid those bonuses. In a prepared statement before the subcommittee, AIG's chairman Ed Liddy called the payouts, quote, distasteful. And yesterday, angry lawmakers said they would retrieve the funds. Here's Senator Charles Schumer.
My colleagues and I are sending a letter to Mr. Liddy informing him that he can go right ahead and tell these employees that are scheduled to get bonuses that they should voluntarily return them. Because if they don't, we plan to virtually tax all of it. He should tell these employees if they don't give the money back, we'll put in place a new law that will allow us to tax these bonuses at a very high rate so that it's returned to its rightful owners, the taxpayers.
We'll get into whether or not they can do that in just a moment. But first, Robert, as you would expect, the finger pointing has begun already. Where the clause in the stimulus bill allowing these bonuses to be paid, where that actually came from? Who wrote it? For example, Senator Chris Dodd, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, says, no, I didn't write it. The president says he didn't have anything to do with it, nor did Tim Geithner. The question is, why didn't anybody see it, or did they?
No, well, that's the question. It's like that comic strip, you know, the Family Circus, where the kid, not me, is the one that's it's everybody's pointing to. This is the crux of the question. It's that classic DC question of who knew what and when. You've got the real big problem is that the bonus structure, the basic structure of it, was known going back to last fall when the first part of the AIG bailout was put forward, and as far as we knew, the Treasury then under Hank Paulson negotiated this bailout with the New York Fed, which was run by Timothy Geithner, who's currently the Treasury Secretary. But Geithner says he didn't know about the latest round of bonuses until a week or so ago, and then he only told the president. So, you know, for the average person taking a look at this, you've got to figure that these people either somebody is being less than truthful, or the whole lot of them, particularly in the context of the Treasury, is being incompetent.
Here's the other part of that, Sherrilyn. Even if we do find out who the person was who put that clause in there, and whether or not Geithner knew, whether or not Obama knew, whether or not Chris Dodd knew, what can they really do about it? They are now trying to come up with ways to recoup this money, but I don't know, and I want you to respond because you're a lawyer, if they have a legal leg to stand on.
Well, certainly they've got contracts in place that they would have to deal with, and that's been the argument that, you know, that we've got these kind of rock-solid contracts with these employees that would require them to pay the bailout, the bonus money, and that if they try and break those contracts, they're going to have to pay out in legal fees, and, of course, we'll be paying those legal fees if the government tries to sue the employees. But the government has so much power. They're in the driver's seat in this. The reality is that all of those employees who were in the financial products division of AIG ought to be very concerned about the possibility that the government can decide that they want to launch a federal investigation into the particular actions of each and every one of the employees in that division to determine whether or not some laws were broken in the management of those financial products for AIG. That's the kind of context in which many people would decide not to take the bonus, would decide to renegotiate the contract. The federal government has a lot of power. The question I really think, Tony, is whether they want to exercise it, because I've got another theory that goes along with Roberts, which is that we're talking about a culture shift. The reason that nobody noticed it in the fall is because Geithner and Paulson, they're all part of the same culture in which this was the norm, that these kinds of bonuses would be paid out. And so I don't think that they affirmatively put it in there. They didn't take it out because it didn't occur to them that this was something beyond the pale. I do think we can begin to try and follow the trail that Senator Ron Wyden has suggested we should follow. He and his main colleague, Olympia Snow, had put a provision in the bill that would have capped bonuses at $100,000, and anything above that would have been taxed at 35%. And that passed through the Senate, and somehow when it got into the conference committee in the House, it was removed. So we could find out who's responsible for removing that provision that was put in, was an amendment put in by two senators that would have gotten us away from this problem, because we would have capped the bonuses at $100,000. Well, so if we really want to know who, we could start there.
You know, you mentioned something that the president said just as he was on the White House lawn preparing to leave Washington to come out here to California, in fact, talking about the change in culture. And he did say that whether he knew or didn't know was really didn't matter, because he is, as the president of the United States, responsible in the end, and that the buck stops for him. A side note to this, though, Robert, is this. Whether or not he's going to take a hit because of this, a Pew poll is showing a dip in President Obama's approval rating to just under 60%. Now, that's still good, not as good as it had been. Over the last month, disapproval of his job performance has increased among Republicans and independents substantially, Democrats remaining pretty positive. But, you know, you can't have too many more of these kinds of things occur, can you?
Well, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things that he has to take a serious look at is his Treasury Secretary, because Mr. Geithner has been on rocky footing literally before he was approved because of his failure to pay taxes. And then he rolled out this whole, TARP assessment package, which seemed to be completely and totally incomprehensible. And now, on top of that, you've got the AIG situation. The president's press secretary, Mr. Gibbs, said that the president has complete confidence in Geithner. I think at this point, he's the only one that does. So I would suggest that if those numbers continue to trail and they don't get a handle on this financial mess, Geithner is going to be the one walking the plank.
Let's talk about another angle in terms of how the president is doing. The former Vice President Dick Cheney gave a television interview in which he discussed many things, including the new president's performance. One might expect what he would probably say about the new president's job so far, but here's what he actually said in an interview with John King.
Do you believe the president of the United States has made Americans less safe?
I do. I think those programs were absolutely essential to the success we enjoyed of being able to collect the intelligence that let us defeat all further attempts to launch attacks against the United States since 9/11.
So, Sherilyn, as we bring our conversation to a close, the president is battling on one front, the economic front, to try to shore things up. And now he's slings and arrows are being directed at him from the previous administration with regard to his foreign policy.
I actually think that the former vice president's comments are irrelevant, and I think actually he's an irrelevant figure right now. I don't think anybody's hanging on the vice president's assessment of whether or not we're safe. Particularly, this was an ironic interview in the same week that the New York Review of Books issued its review of the report of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which demonstrates in no uncertain terms that the United States was engaged in torture and that it was sanctioned at the highest levels, and I think most people would assume that the vice president was involved in the loop. This would be a time in which I think the vice president would want to be, as we say, on the low. And so it was quite surprising for him to come out and make those comments. Even the former president, Bush, has said that the new president deserves his silence. I think more than anyone, we deserve the silence from Vice President Cheney.
And I'd also actually think that the former president also wouldn't mind Dick Cheney's silence on this as well, given that he's still criticizing former President Bush for not pardoning Scooter Libby. So I think Vice President Cheney has some issues that have to be resolved on a number of levels.
Talking about silence, I've only got about 30 seconds for this, but the president coming out here to California to appear of all places on the Jay Leno show. First time a sitting president has ever done that, Sherilyn.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I can't imagine that it could hurt him, but it's been a tough week, and I think he's enormously appealing when he appears, and so I expect his numbers will climb back up a little bit in the next few days.
I think it's somewhat ill-advised. I think he should be waiting until maybe, you know, when the official first 100 days are over, because when all this other chaos is going on, I think it looks a little bit too rock star-ish to be going on the Jay Leno show at this point.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Let me thank both of you for coming on and for coming on as many times as you have as part of our political roundtable on Wednesdays. As you know, this is the last one that we are doing. We appreciate it, and we know the audience does as well.
And Tony, it's been a real pleasure working with you and Farai and everyone, and we'll definitely miss being here.
Thank you very much. Sherilyn, I feel
like the show could continue.
A civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, joining us from the studios of NPR in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Well, for the last 6-plus years, we have covered politics in some way, shape, or form on this show, which has gone through a few hosts and incarnations during that time. One thing has been constant, though: Mary Frances Berry. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and has been with us talking politics throughout. And she joins me now one last time. Hello, Mary.
Tony, has it really been 6 years?
Yes, it has. 2002,
oh,
when we began under the Tavis Smiley banner, you and I and a few other folks.
Yes.
You know, you were the chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and one of the things I wanted to get you to talk about to help put this in perspective for people is how media and politics, our roles have changed dramatically, I think, since that time, particularly as it relates to having a new president in the White House, who just today, as I was noticing as he was getting on the helicopter to leave the White House to go to Air Force One to come to California, held an impromptu news conference and took a few questions. And one was from a black reporter. And that's not something that we would maybe have seen 6 years ago.
Right. There were very few black reporters who covered the beat at the White House. It gradually changed over the years, and very few of them got to ask questions, even if they were there.
That's true.
So that's sort of unusual, yes.
Unusual
to have a black president and a black reporter asking the question.
At the same time, absolutely.
Right.
How do you think the election changed the political landscape in this country, or do you?
Well, it's changed the landscape entirely. All of the talk of the time of Bush's presidency from 2002, when we started all the way up until Obama's election, things got more and more depressing as time went on. Even though Bush got actually elected in 2004 as opposed to the disputed election in 2000, still most of the news was bad news, and we had a steady diet of bad news and flubs and this and worries about war and worries about domestic policy and civil liberties and civil rights, and it was just bad news. It was like everything was downhill. And the country was depressed psychologically. And Bush, now that he's gone, you've got a breath of fresh air. Everybody is waiting expectantly. People have been happy. They've celebrated. And now the news is always about, you know, what is going on now and how is it going to play out, and with most people hoping that it will play out positively after so much depression.
Are you surprised at the level of engagement of what I would arguably say is the black community at large in the political arena, both as voters, as viewers, as readers, and particularly as political pundits?
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, once the Obama phenomenon took off and people got engaged it's the first time anything has happened to make them get engaged, and there's still identity politics. Whether, you know, some people say there's no such thing as identity politics. I think that should be consigned to the trash heap, that idea. People identify with Obama, African Americans especially, and so people feel that they have a reason to pay attention, to talk about, to think about, to focus on, and to hope. And they're just interested in everything the Obamas do, not just the president, but Michelle and the children. And it's all new, seeing them in the White House. And so it's a new thing every day. And I expect the community to be engaged for some time to come.
What would you say about this? There's been a great deal of talk about the partisan battles in Washington and attempts to for the Republican Party to try to get black folk and others to, you know, come over to their side. Michael Steele's now the head of the party. Shelby Steele, the conservative columnist from California, has written a column about that issue. In fact, we're going to discuss that in Bloggers a little bit later in this program. Is it likely that there is going to be a shift, do you think, of black folks moving toward the Republicans?
Well, I wrote a op-ed piece last week in which I said the Republicans paved the way for Obama in that they had picked all of these conservative black faces for years, starting with the Clarence Thomas, Pendleton, and going on down the line to Condoleezza Rice, and then having Colin Powell as the moderate. And they had accustomed the American people to having black people who weren't radicals like people think Al Sharpton is or something, and being like Jesse Jackson, and that this, in a way, paved the way. And by naming Michael Steele, they're getting a little bit of payoff from doing this. What they do with Michael Steele and how this is carried out, it depends on two things. One, how successful Obama is, and so that he can sustain the Obama phenomenon, and two, whether Michael Steele and the Republicans can figure out something to say other than just being critical.
You know, we've had an interesting run. You mentioned some names as we bring this to a close. And before I let you go, I have to thank you, Mary Frances Berry, for coming on the show as often as you do. We call you late sometimes. We call you at the last moment sometimes. And you're sick sometimes. And you're like, you are a real trooper and you have something to say. But I'll end this with this. We've had Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and now Barack Obama in succession in the highest offices in the country. Black folks are kind of on a roll politically, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. Maybe the next one will be Michelle Obama as president.
That'll be very interesting to see. Mary Frances Berry, thank you again. That was Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. The gulf between the internet haves and have-nots is shrinking, and according to a new report, that's good news for African Americans. We turn now to Jeffrey Bennett for our final web check-in. He is the digital producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So apparently the so-called digital divide is narrowing. Tell us about that.
Well, in 4 years, an estimated 56% of African Americans will be online, that rate growing by about 2% each year. And this is according to an agency called eMarketer, which specializes in internet market research. So right now, they say 46% of black Americans use the web, compared to 66% of the white population and about 70% of Asian Americans. And one of the report's analysts says that younger black internet users are most comfortable visiting social networks, downloading and streaming music and videos, and blogging and playing games, pretty much as one might expect. And black baby boomers are online in high numbers, mostly for checking email and catching up on news.
Well, this marks, as we said, the final time that we're going to hear about the latest happenings on our blog and the wider blogosphere. So we are joined by our other web producer named Jeff, Mr. Jeffrey Gardner. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So News and Notes made some great strides at incorporating an online experience into our radio show. You were a big part of that. Tell us some of the highlights.
Oh, wow. Well, back in the beginning of, if you remember, the Gen 6 controversy, News and Notes was really the first and only national show to follow that story in the beginning before it hit the mainstream and really blew up. And as a result, there were sites like Color of Change that used News and Notes as a rallying point for their cause. And we had blog posts that would generate hundreds of comments, you know, just based on this. And so that was a really big deal for us in the beginning.
You know, we're going to be having our final bloggers roundtable coming up after this discussion. So let me ask both of you, starting with you, Jeffrey, how and why were bloggers so crucial to our show?
Well, I tend to see bloggers as the social and cultural temperature takers of the community. And I think one of the great things about having bloggers on this show is that for people who had no idea what News and Notes was, but were readers of a particular blog, they came to know our show in a certain way. And then for people who listened to the show but didn't really care too much for blogging or blogs, were introduced to new voices. And so in that way, I think that sort of symbiotic relationship helped grow our audience and I think served the kind of reporting and coverage that we do.
Let me ask you, Jeffrey, do you think, Jeffrey Gardner, that we helped to expand the credibility of bloggers through this show?
Yeah, the blogosphere is growing in size, and you know, I'd like to think that our blog has something to do with the credibility aspect. You know, a lot of people look at blogs as this new source of information, but who are you talking to? And you know, NPR has credibility, and there's something that goes along with that name, I think, and you know, associate it. We bring on bloggers, and we give them that. We lend them a much larger voice than they normally would. And I think as a result, we see the bloggers that we've had on, their own sites have grown, you know, exponentially.
You know, I suppose they've helped Jeffrey Bennett to, I don't know, shape our program somewhat.
They have. And to, I want to emphasize a point, but not pat ourselves on the back too much. I think it's important to say that our show is the only show on a national stage that highlights black bloggers the way that we do. And I think when our show goes off the air, there will be a void in that space. And I think, you know, we give bloggers a voice on our show. We also give our listeners a voice in the show. I think when this show was reformatted a few years ago, we were given a mandate to unite the radio listeners with online listeners. And for NPR and for some sectors of the public radio space, that meant forging new ground, and we did that. So a lot of our listeners might not know, but you know, the comments they leave on our website, their thoughts make their way into our editorial meetings every day. And sometimes it shapes the way we cover stories. Sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, we're listening, and we've appreciated their input.
You talk about how we've expanded. One of the ways that we have done that, even though this is a radio program, Jeff Gardner, is through the video presence that we have. And you are our main video producer. Talk for a moment about some of the most memorable interviews and performances that you taped right here in Studio B.
Yeah, right here, like you said, we have this five-camera system that's really great. And really what separates the technology isn't so much what, you know, what the emphasis is the content. And, you know, the discussions and conversations that you and Farai had with our guests, our ability to videotape and show that, you know, it really lends a whole new side to things. And, like, we had a conversation with Rev Run and his wife Justine, and it would have been a normal interview, but when you see the video and you see the reactions in the back and forth, so you can see their facial expressions, and it really becomes a whole new thing.
I'll argue with her, but I realize at that moment, or she'll realize at that moment, okay, she's not agreeing with me.
Yeah.
One of us
no,
are going to have to back down.
No, you keep saying that, babe.
I was still making
okay,
my point.
Okay, okay. Anyway.
That was quite an argument between Reverend Run and his wife, and you didn't get the full flavor of it. You're right, unless you could actually see her expressions when they were talking to each other. Let's end it with this, guys. What about our Facebook and YouTube presence? Will that end on Friday as well?
Our social networks will remain intact, so people can still go to Facebook and YouTube and check out our archive of video and then leave comments if they have something to say that you know about our show 2 weeks from now. But our newsletter ends this Friday. So Friday's our last day for our daily newsletter, and we'll have more information there about how people can find other NPR email newsletters.
Jeff, you guys did great work.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Pleasure having you with us. Jeffrey Bennett and Jeffrey Gardner are the digital producers for News & Notes. They join me here in the studios of NPR West. Now, on to our final Wednesday Bloggers Roundtable and some of the hot topics we're talking about online. AIG bonuses continue to fuel outrage around the country. Online activists jump into the fight over stimulus money, and our bloggers reflect on their time at News and Notes. So, with us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race, also blogs for AOL Black Voices. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, he blogs over at Three Brothers and a Sister, and he hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. And comedian and self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston, he is the co-founder of Jack and Jill Politics and also writes for the Huffington Post. Hello, everybody.
Hello there, Tony. Hey.
You guys are our A-team of bloggers.
Oh, go on.
I'm not kidding.
No, really, go on.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'll let you know.
Listening.
I'll let you know when we're done here.
So let's talk about AIG first. And here's what the president had to say. He said many things since this, but this one sort of encapsulates, I think, how the president feels about what went down at AIG.
In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses. You know, we already have resolution authority. Excuse me, I'm choked up with anger here.
Polls say, let's talk about this in terms of how it impacts him and us, because polls say, Carmen, I'm going to come to you first. More than 96% of African-American voters voted for him for president. All right, we know that. A lot of hopes and expectations have been placed on his shoulders. All right, we know that as well. Here's the question. How should his supporters stay realistic about his policies and work? I mean, it's our money, too.
Of course it's our money. And I'm questioning how you define realistic. I certainly think if this so many billions of dollars are being spent, it's absolutely appropriate for all people, and particularly his constituents, his core constituents, to want that money distributed not just to the Wall Street fat cats, but to also folks who need to eat, who need to find a job, and who need to preserve their homes. So I don't know why that would be considered unrealistic.
Well, what I'm getting at, and perhaps we'll have to answer this after the break, Baratunde, is it realistic to say, look, Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, you're messing around with our money. We supported you, but we need to criticize you and your policies. What about that, Baratunde?
I think it's absolutely essential to do both. I mean, there's, you know, blind support is not helpful either to the people or to the president, and we need both to feel empowered and to succeed. So he needs that pressure, but I think we have to do it in a way that isn't destructive or needlessly negative, and that doesn't get the job done. You know, I'd hate to be a rich banker right now. These guys don't know how to manage image, don't know how to manage money, clearly, and they're in banking. So this has been a fail on every possible angle of the whole situation, from the setup of these complex financial instruments in the beginning to the bailout process and now to the fallout over what's called bonuses. No one has tolerance for this when millions of people are suffering, when factories are shutting down, when people can't afford food and are getting kicked off their health care. So the rage is there. And I think if we can communicate that, you know, he must be feeling it. He's got a really tough job.
Well, let me stop you there, only because the clock is running out. Because we're going to come back, because Kevin hasn't had his chance, and there's no way in the world I'm going to get out of here without letting Kevin Ross talk about
this. You know, that's the judge.
So we'll be back to continue this conversation with Carmen Dixon, Baratunde Thurston, and Kevin Ross in just a moment. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us today, Carmen Dixon, media consultant who writes all about race and also writes for AOL Black Voices, former L.A. Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister, and Baratunde Thurston, co-founder of Jack and Jill Politics and a regular contributor to The Huffington Post. All right, so before the break, we were talking about Obama. And what made me think of this, Kevin, is I have a friend who I've been friends with a long time. We talk politics all the time. And she and I had to stop speaking to each other for a period of time because I had the audacity to be critical of something that Barack Obama had done. And there's a sense among some of us in the Black community that he is, you know, beyond criticism. It's crazy.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's interesting. I have tweets that go out at twitter.com, Kev Ross. And one of the things I tweeted about was the woman Carmen over at Racialicious. And she had talked about this study that the Christian Science Monitor, actually was an article that talked about how Black men right now, you have seen this drop, 7.8% have fewer jobs than in 2007. When you look and see what's going on with people of color, you are seeing them say, okay, how is it that people in New Orleans, when they were in need, that they were called refugees, that they were called lazy, that they were called people that were not contributing to society. And then you contrast that with these folks that are just taking money and seemingly in a way that we wouldn't expect President Obama to have even gotten to this point with. You know, meaning that when you have someone like a Timothy Geithner, we were all sold from the president. This is the man who gets it. This is the man who no one else can do this the way that he can do it in terms of this execution.
He said that today.
And then you see the incompetence. Now, sure, it's only been 60 days, but anytime you have a company that has taken $170 billion, we as a country own 80% of that. They have lost $62 billion. And then they're saying, well, contractually, we have to pay these folks almost $200 million in bonuses. It's not a good look for our president. And being a black Republican specifically, I think it's an opportunity for people of color to say, you know what? We can't put all our eggs in a basket anymore as it relates to Democrats.
Right.
Because the fact of the matter is, you know, sometimes even the best intentions don't result in our best interests being advanced.
Well, you know, you mentioned a good point. It's a great segue to continue this conversation having to do with Shelby Steele, a conservative Republican columnist here in California, who wrote an article in Monday's Wall Street Journal. It was an opinion piece entitled Why the GOP Cannot Win with Minorities. And it was, you know, very academic in terms of its tone. But to cut through all of that beautiful writing, his point was, you know, don't be taken by one group. And don't put yourself in a situation where you don't even look at the other side, Carmen Dixon.
Well, having been a Republican for 8 years, now I'm an independent, but having been a Republican for 8 years, I am a strong believer that the Democratic Party takes blacks for granted. And further, that our democracy depends on two viable, strong parties to make it work.
Preach.
But so it's very interesting. You know, I had a chance to speak with Michael Steele at the State of the Black Union the other weekend, and I told him he had an ally to come on my site to write pieces because I believe in the effort of the GOP to attract blacks and Latinos and mm-hmm. Asians and all people of color to that party for the strength of our democracy.
I was with Carmen, and we were actually at the Prince concert. I was at the Prince concert sitting next to Michael Steele. At one point, we were doing the bird, and I was like, he's a brother.
Well, wait now. There's, you know, there's real argument about Michael Steele and
right.
whether Michael Steele represents. So we don't want to I'm trying to make sure we keep this in some sort of balance here.
But just real quick, I wanted to say, though, when he doesn't speak out against his fellow Republicans making comments like we're going to become Zimbabwe, when he lets comments like that, when Michael Steele lets comments from the GOP like that float out into the ether and doesn't check them, he turns off any potential black
voter. Well, Baratunde, I got to tell you, even after having read Michael Steele's argument, I thought he made an argument for why black people should not go to the Republican
right.
Party.
Yeah, he's not a good spokesperson, and I think he's a spokesperson or a salesperson without a good product right now. We're recovering from 8 years of neglect of quote unquote faith in the market rather than faith in some sort of more equitable outcome for American people, and Michael Steele's not the guy to do it. Shelby Steele is not the guy to do it. This is a guy who wrote a book called Why Obama Can't Win,
right.
and he has egg all over his face.
Absolutely.
And his publisher's face for that. So the argument rings hollow when you oversimplify the relationship between black people and the Democratic Party. I'm not loyal to the party, but I am loyal to progressive ideas. And this is a party that has fought in a movement that has fought for equal application and equal protection under the law.
Sometimes.
And those
I was going to say parts of it.
But let me bring this full circle. You have to call out your own party when they constantly run games and marketing gimmicks, and when the substance of providing for the American people is left off the table.
Let me bring the whole thing full circle, and why I raised the issue of criticizing President Obama, bringing up Shelby Steele, talking about Michael Steele, is that on this program, at this moment, this is an opportunity for us to discuss this.
Right.
That opportunity is going away in about 48 hours. What is the significance of having a place? And I don't want to sound too self-serving, but having a place where you can have an exchange of these kinds of ideas. When we leave, you guys, your blogs will be the place where folks will have to go to have this conversation.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Tony, because what I have found in these last years and year and a half that I've been involved with NPR and this show is that I did not know. I read Baratunde, but I didn't hear Baratunde.
Right.
I read Carmen, but I didn't hear her. So, you know, even with individuals who, for whatever reason, they don't want to give their real names on their blogs or they only give their first name, what this show has done is that it has forced us all to come from behind that curtain. And I'm excited about the possibilities because, see, now you've given it to us. You know, now you've given Baratunde voice. So you can't take it back now. So whether it's going to the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio or Baratunde hearing.
That plug.
Yeah, hey.
You are so smooth. Hey, man. You are so smooth.
Because there's no reason why we shouldn't have Jack and Jill Politics Radio.
Right.
There's
yeah.
no reason why Carmen Dixon is not going to be able to really just blow her radio show that she's getting ready to launch.
Launching
right now.
April 27th.
And so the conversation's going to keep going, and it's unfortunate that NPR doesn't see the value
right.
that we ourselves
Absolutely.
Recognize that value is just going to move into a different space.
Well, I can't speak for NPR in terms of whether or not they see the value, because perhaps that value will reemerge in a new form.
Well, hey, there's a saying, and I shows, can't hear you. You're shows, actions are speaking too loud. So the bottom line is, if we're not here, then that means I'm going to call Baratunde and say, look, brother, come on my show.
Sure,
Baratunde,
right.
if you want to start a show on Blog Talk Radio,
right.
I will come on your show. Let's get Field Negro. Let's get Pam from Pam's yep. House Blend. Let's get Gina McCauley
Gina,
and
everybody.
Keep the party going.
Our time is, unfortunately,
oh,
our time is that we got
no,
20 seconds.
I want to talk about arguing with the Republican
well,
Muslim,
okay.
the black Republican
you'll have
Muslim.
To do that
was
on
my favorite
You'll have to
moment.
Do that on your
do,
blog. Let me
do
thank
on your
you,
radio
Baratunde
show.
Thurston.
There you go.
Let me thank you, Carmen
thank
Dixon.
You.
Let me
thank you.
Kevin
thank
Ross.
You.
It has been our pleasure to have you as part of our contributors, and I know that the audience feels as we do. Thank you again.
It's been an honor.
Thank you.
Very
we'll
much.
See you on the internet, y'all.
Yep.
All this week, we've been talking to the people who work behind the scenes here at News & Notes, and today we turn to Sonata Lee Narsis, a producer here at News & Notes, about her time on this show. Hello, Sonata.
Hi, Tony.
You know, you are the youngest person on the staff here at News & Notes, and you started off as an intern back in 2006, and then you came back as a producer and now as a director.
That's right. I was still in graduate school when I started here. I really loved the show. I was really excited to start working here after I graduated, so I'm really happy.
And we were glad to have you here. So
thank
what has
you.
Been one of the most memorable stories that you have produced?
One of my very first assignments on News & Notes was for our month-long series on addiction. It looked at things like gambling, shopping, substance abuse, and I was assigned the segment on food addiction. So at first, I wasn't sure what route to take with this segment. In our editorial meeting, we discussed possible guests for the show, like nationally syndicated radio host Big Boy or American Idol's Randy Jackson. They've both had a weight loss surgery. So I thought that they would be great for the show because I knew people would be able to relate to them, but I didn't know if their stories really represented food addiction. And that was something we really tried to define in this segment. What is food addiction? Is there a difference between someone who overeats and someone who is literally addicted to food? So for the answer to that question, we turn to addiction specialist Marty Lerner. He directs the Milestones in Recovery Eating Disorders program. And News & Notes former host Farai Chidea asked Marty Lerner to explain when someone crosses the line between overeating and food addiction.
It's very similar to other addictions. For instance, if I can borrow an analogy between a heavy social drinker and an alcoholic, you know, there comes a time when someone wakes up in the morning and they look back and they realize instead of their controlling their consumption of alcohol, now the alcohol is controlling themselves. So one of the earmarks of food addiction or any addiction is to find yourself in the quagmire of wanting to not engage in a behavior or consume a substance and finding yourself compelled to do that despite the consequences. So a loss of control is one earmark that delineates someone with a bad habit versus someone who has an addictive process they're involved with.
So who did you end up finding for the piece?
I turned to Overeaters Anonymous for our guest, Vic, who is a recovering food addict. And Farai started off the interview by asking Vic to give an example of a day when she completely lost control of her eating.
It wasn't a day. It was the day before and that day and the next day. But anyway, okay, so I wake up in the morning totally hungover. Dr. Lerner, Marty, described very well, having lost control. So I wake up, I feel terrible, and the last thing I want to do, I think, in my rational brain, is eat because I feel so bad. And yet I know that if I take one bite of anything, I'll be off and running, and I'm scared. I'm really scared. I'm living a totally isolated life, and I'm because of this food addiction, and I'm scared because I'll do it to myself again. But
let me just ask one thing. When you say hungover, do you mean hungover from overeating or hungover?
Oh, yes, purely overeating.
What's an overeating hangover feel like?
Well, okay, I've just woken up from a night of terrible sweats, tossing and turning because of the excesses in my gut. My head feels like it's stuffed with concrete cotton. Every nerve in my body feels like it's got acid on it. I feel completely demoralized, ugly. I'm also physically bloated. Just like stuffed. It's hard for me.
I think that you've given us a lot of descriptions, you know.
Okay, great. All right. So now you want to know next?
Yeah, you were saying that you were afraid to start eating,
okay,
but I'm...
I would be afraid to start eating, but there was nothing else to do because I was dirty. I couldn't fit in my clothes. I had no friends left because I was so isolated with the food. So there was nothing left to do but eat. And if I stopped eating for 1 second, I might remember something. Oh, and by the way, all the time that I would be eating, not all the time, but at the beginning when I would start out eating, it would like be a break for my imagination, and I'd sit there stuffing my face and thinking of all the great things I was going to do when I got through eating, what a success I would be. But soon those thoughts would be supplanted because I was just terrorized by what I was doing to myself.
We also spoke to Libby Beer, a food addiction counselor at the Illinois Institute for Addiction Recovery.
It sounds to me, and maybe I'm wrong, that what Vic has been going through was an extreme case. How extreme was it? And what, and you hinted at this, what makes someone an addict as opposed to a social overeater?
Sure. And to be honest with you, I don't really think Vic's case is too far from most of the cases that we work with here at our center. I don't know if maybe Vic, if she's has been in treatment, if she could speak to maybe some of the other people that she knows, but her case really does just seem like one of the, just if I can use the word, normal cases that we see here quite often with someone who truly has food addiction. It is this severe.
So, Sonata, what was it about this piece that stood out for you?
Well, Vic described her struggle with food addiction so vividly. I think we hear people depict their struggles with drug addiction in movies and on television, but I don't think we've ever really heard a food addict speak so candidly and descriptively about their addiction. I also thought Libby Beer was an important component to this segment because she explained that although Vic's story seemed to be an extreme case of food addiction, her struggle really is not that unique.
Let's talk about you for a minute, okay? We said in the beginning that you came here as an intern, and I know that you have worked, you worked at a newspaper for a while, and I know you worked at CBS, but in terms of on air or working in a radio talk show news opinion setting, this is the first time you've really done that.
That's right.
So how would you describe that experience for people who are trying to do what you've already done?
Oh my goodness. A huge adrenaline rush would be a description I would give. You know, we're a live show, so we've got a certain amount of time to get it done and get it on air. So you're operating off of instincts a lot of times.
So do you feel that you are this show maybe helped prepare you for your next
spot? Oh, definitely.
Spot?
I've learned so much here. It's just been incredible.
So yeah, we're proud of you. Feel like you grew up with us.
I feel like I did.
That was Sonata Lee Narcisse, a producer and director here at News & Notes, talking about a segment she produced on food addiction. Mm-hmm. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, March Madness is sweeping the nation. Let the bracket busting begin. New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden gives us his picks. I'm Tony Cox. This is News and Notes.